Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, everybody. We got a depressing one today because it's about war. War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. War, good God, y'all. My guest is Julia Yaffe, founding partner and Washington correspondent for Puck Media. Julia is a veteran journalist who's written for The Atlantic Monthly and The New Yorker. Julia was born in Russia, and in addition to covering Washington, spends a lot of her time covering the war in Ukraine, Putin's war. He is responsible for the horror that we see unfolding every day. A giant miscalculation, of course, on Putin's part. He thought he'd invade and be in Kyiv in a matter of days. We've done a few of these podcasts on Ukraine. Frank Four of the Atlantic Monthly spoke with us right at the start of the war on Biden's masterful leadership in putting this enormous coalition that's behind Ukraine in the place. And just when we begin to see some potential rifts, we see these allies agree to continue to step up in the last couple of weeks in regard to tanks. Julia, not alone in wondering where we might be in this war if that kind of commitment of more advanced weapons had happened sooner. Alexander Vindman, who was director of European affairs for the National Security Council under the Trump administration, of course, he's the guy who blew the whistle on the Trump shakedown call with Zelensky. He was on with me not such a long time ago and told me that he was optimistic about Ukraine's progress in the war this winter. And Julia takes a more pessimistic view. So I called Colonel Vindman after I spoke with Julia Yaffe to get his take. And Vindman told me that he continues to be optimistic in terms of Ukraine gaining territory in the south, and as I understood him, making real progress toward cutting off Russia's land corridor to Crimea. Julia, as you'll hear, is not so optimistic, as I said. She talks very chillingly about the carnage in what she describes as almost World War I trench warfare, and the use of prisoners by the mercenary Wagner Group, led by Yevgeny Prigozhin, and the unbelievable carnage and brutality. Some very, very, very dark stuff. There are Republicans, MAGA Republicans, some of the worst people in Congress. Marjorie Taylor Greene comes to mind for some reason. Right before the midterm, she told a rally that under Republicans, not another penny will go to Ukraine. That is such a bad idea for so many reasons. As Julie and I discussed, this is a bargain for the United States. We've spent about 5, maybe 6% of our defense budget on this war, and we have significantly degraded the Russian army, our sworn enemy, with the massive support of all these allies. Russia is the second biggest military in the world. The Ukrainians have killed or wounded over 100,000 Russian troops, and that was as of a few months ago. And not one American soldier has been killed or wounded or gotten trench foot in Ukraine. We are eroding Russia's defense capabilities every day at no risk to American lives by deploying our weapons, our technology, our logistics and intelligence seamlessly with Ukrainians. I'm not an arms dealer, but Ukraine has been just a hell of a showcase or American ingenuity. Meanwhile, the Russians have been showing the world just how inept they are on pretty much every score. The New York Times reported that Ukrainian troops have used cell phone calls to their families and stuff, basically because there's very little communications on the front lines. And that Ukrainian forces have used these calls to locate them and wipe them out in large numbers. Now, I don't know if you remember Ted Cruz sending a viral tweet, which featured a very muscular Russian soldier with a shaved head who was doing push-ups and jumping out of a plane and had, like, staring down the scope of his rifle. And he juxtaposed it next to a U.S. Army video of a woman soldier who had been raised by two mothers. And Ted wrote that it made Americans into pansies. And he said, perhaps a woke, emasculated military is not the best idea. Well, Ted, a lot of your super emasculated Russian buddies have been taken out by a Ukrainian army supported by American intelligence and logistics teams comprised of men, women, and non-binary military personnel and daughters and sons of different couples. Still, as the war enters its second year, there is real uncertainty ahead. Okay, it is a depressing one today. For a change, Julia Yaffe joins us in a moment. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Your founding partner and the Washington correspondent for Puck.
Sure I am.
And explain Puck.
So we're the hottest new media company, and everybody should subscribe to us.
That's what I was
going to
say.
Yeah, of course. And we write about kind of what really happens in the halls of American power, you know, from Wall Street to Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Washington. And yours truly writes the Tuesday Dispatch, which is usually about matters of national security, foreign policy.
And that's what you mainly cover is, and
correct.
And you're on about 6 months ago mm-hmm. about the war in Ukraine. About a month ago, I had Alexander Vindman.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and Alex was very optimistic about a month ago about Ukraine's position in this. And he was kind of saying, well, Ukraine's going to take it to them during the winter, that they are equipped to do that. They're cycling soldiers in and out. They're rested. And they have a proper equipment, and the Russians don't. And that they're going to continue to build on the momentum they had up to a couple months ago, and that everything was looking good, and that within, a certain amount of time that Russia would be coming to the table. That was sort of where he sounded like what he was saying at the time. And right now it feels very different.
I mean, that I think even a month ago would have been, I wasn't there for the conversation, but even a month ago, that would have been a very optimistic assessment. I was mm-hmm. not hearing that from anybody I was talking to.
Okay.
What I was hearing a month ago is basically what we're seeing now, which is this kind of World War I style trench warfare with a little bit of territory changing hands here and there, but not much changing. And that much of the fighting would happen in the spring. Yes. And that either the Ukrainians or the Russians or both would make a big push in the spring fighting season, but that the winter would generally just be a slog and a really kind of entrenchment of this war of attrition.
And that's what we've been hearing about in Donetsk, and that's the region.
Mm-hmm.
Is Donetsk the Donbass region, or they're the same, one and the same?
So it's the Don River Basin. So it's the Donbass, like basin. That's what it means. It's a like region as in geographic region, and then Donetsk is like a Ukrainian state.
So what is happening right now is you're saying basically World War I style trench warfare, but there's been in the last few days a couple of advancements by the Russians, and so this is the Wagner group, right?
Yeah, which is one of the kind of scarier developments of the, or let's just say, I wouldn't say scary, one of the more sinister developments of this war, which is the empowerment of the Wagner group and of its owner, Yevgeny Prigozhin.
And he is a an ally
psychopath.
Psychopath. Ally psychopath of Putin's.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these are mercenaries, right? Some of them.
Yes, and like technically. So here's the deal with Prigozhin. Prigozhin is himself a former convict. He spent the entire 1980s in jail. He went to jail in part for stealing some earrings and boots off of a lady. And he did that by asking her for a smoke. And as she reached into her purse, he started strangling her. And when she lost consciousness, he stole her earrings and her boots. And then when he got out, he started selling hot dogs and he went into the restaurant business. This was the 1990s when capitalism was coming into Russia. And somewhere along the way, probably in the late 90s, he met Vladimir Putin, who was, or maybe early 90s. And then he became known as Putin's chef. Like he owned a bunch of restaurants that Putin liked. He brought George W. Bush to one of his restaurants. He brought Jacques Chirac to one of his restaurants. And then Prigozhin starts getting contracts, these massive catering contracts to cater to basically school cafeterias and the military and the police. But most of that money was going out the back door to fund this mercenary company that would show up in Syria or in Eastern Ukraine in 2014 or in various African countries to do basically work that the Russian government wanted to do, but didn't want to have its fingerprints on. And the Russian government thought that this is what Blackwater did, that Blackwater was an invention or a creation of the US government and was controlled by the US government, and that that's what Wagner was going to be. And they purposely kind of dissembled, and anytime Wagner was mentioned in the Russian press, the reporters and the editors would be sued and they would lose, obviously, because these are Russian courts. But with the start of the war, Prigozhin threw all those masks off and said, yep, I own Wagner and we're fighting in Ukraine. But what he's been doing is, I mean, he's basically fighting for the Russian state. They're not really mercenaries. I mean, they're getting paid, but mostly now they're prisoners.
These are prisoners in Russian prisons who are given their quote freedom if they come
survive.
Yeah.
Because the casualty rate in Wagner, we've seen reported, is somewhere like 80%. So he spent the summer and early fall going to prisons, which obviously you need permission at the highest level for. He would go in and say, listen, you sign a contract with me for 6 months. And if you survive, you go home, you get your record expunged and or not expunged, you get whatever, you get forgiven and you go back out into society.
Wow.
And yeah, so now there's news of a murderer, a convicted murderer who killed several people who did his 6 months in Wagner and is now hanging out in Turkey.
Okay.
Just living it up. But most of them don't make it. Like 80% are killed. And he has sent, by some accounts, as many as 50,000 Russian convicts to fight in Ukraine. And what's also nuts is that when they go into battle, they barely have any equipment, but they do have kind of Stalin World War II style. There are officers behind them who, if they start retreat, if these convicts start retreating, Wagner officers are supposed to shoot them. And all right, if they're caught deserting, they are brought back. Their heads are taped to cement blocks, and then they get a sledgehammer to the head. Like ISIS style.
Okay. If you're listening.
I told you, he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
But now he has an army.
Now he has an army. And so Putin has called up 300,000 troops.
Yeah, after September.
Okay. And that's a one-time deal.
We don't know. The Kremlin has been dissembling quite aggressively ever since. So they announced a partial mobilization. Putin himself announced a, quote, partial mobilization in September. It freaked everybody out. There were protests. Something like 700,000 men of military age fled in 2 weeks, which is insane. Like almost 1 million people fleeing a country in 2 weeks. That's bonkers.
And how did they get out? Did they have to
like
find
some of them
way?
Got out on scooters. Some of them got out on foot. Some of them got out on an airplane ticket. Some of them got out driving, standing in traffic jams that lasted, you know, several days. But because of that, and because they knew, the Kremlin knew that this likely wouldn't be enough, they never announced an official end to the mobilization. And every time they were pressed on it, they said, we don't need to end it. It's kind of, it's implied that it's over. We don't need to announce an official end. And meanwhile, reports were coming in from various regions that people were still being called up, 1,000 here, a few hundred there. And every time the Kremlin was asked about whether they would end the mobilization, they would deflect. And now there are rumors going around that Putin, and some reports that Putin is going to call up quietly, and I don't know how you can do this quietly, but another 200,000 Russians.
And how are the Russian people reacting to this? Not that they have much of a choice, but I'd like to know.
They do. Everybody has a choice. Whether it's a good choice or not is a different question. I think we saw a lot of people voted with their feet and left the country. You know, it's hard to tell what people think in a brutal authoritarian regime that has gotten even more brutal over the last year. I mean, the stories coming out of Russia these days are totally insane. You have teachers reporting on their, you know, middle school students to the police and vice versa. You have college students ratting each other out to police and being arrested. Like the police are responding and saying, okay, we're going to arrest this fifth grader. We're going to arrest this sixth grade teacher. We're going to arrest this college student.
This is sort of a Kafka totalitarian state, even worse than it was before this war.
Oh, much, much worse, because now any kind of dissent has been really, truly criminalized because you can't criticize the armed forces. You can't call the special military operation a war. Anything that diverges from the official line of the military or the Kremlin is considered disinformation and therefore criminal. And people are going to jail. We know hundreds of people have been arrested and now dozens have been given, you know, lengthy, the prison sentences. And these aren't prisons that they're going to. They're going to penal colonies that were once gulags. So it's dangerous for people to tell us how they think. But from what we understand and from the little bit of reporting that's coming out of Russia, I would really recommend everybody listen to this amazing episode of The Daily, the New York Times' daily podcast that came out shortly before the new year. It was Valerie Hopkins, who has been in and out of Moscow, and Sabrina Tavernese, who is a former Russia correspondent for the New York Times. And Valerie Hopkins went and stood outside a military recruitment post and was talking to the men going in and to their, you know, wives and mothers and girlfriends. And much of what she heard, and again, these are the people who showed up, right? These aren't the people who fled. These aren't the people who hid in their apartments so that they wouldn't be handed a draft notice. What Valerie heard was that these people were completely resigned to their fate. They felt that they were little people, that things were being decided for them up high in the Kremlin, and that they had no control over their own fate. And it sucked, but that's just how it is. And that's how it always was in Russia. And that's how it was always going to be in Russia. And that fighting against it was absolutely pointless. And all you could do was just kind of grit your teeth and bear it and hope you survive.
So that sounds very Russian.
Well, yeah, because it is, because they're in Russia and, and they're Russian and, you know, living through Russian history yet again.
Okay, we have to break for a commercial, and here it is.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Now, of course, we know that our... We're told that Russia withdrew from, or the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan when that was going badly. This is going much worse than Afghanistan went. It's just that Putin has doubled down and doubled down and doubled down and doubled down, and he's not going to stop.
Well, there are major differences. Russia or the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan after 10 years. And in the 10 years between when the war was started and when it was ended, massive political changes took place inside the Soviet Union. The biggest change was the election of Mikhail Gorbachev as the General Secretary of the Soviet Union in 1985, who in turn introduced massive political and economic and social changes in the country, wherein he loosened up all kinds of restrictions on what was allowed to be said in the media, how the political system worked. And by 1989, it was a totally different country. It was a much freer country. Dissent was possible, both outside the government and inside the government. And he was just a totally different leader. Unfortunately, that decision and Gorbachev's style of leadership also led to the moment when a young Vladimir Putin was in Dresden watching crowds threaten to take the KGB outpost that he was stationed in. And he had to bluff and bullshit his way out of that situation to get the crowds to retreat while he and his staff were burning sensitive papers inside. And, you know, in the very famous story, he calls Moscow trying to get instructions for what to do. And he's told Moscow is silent. And this resonated with him, you know, completely broke him. He couldn't understand how this massive, powerful empire had just completely fallen apart and lost its power. And he kind of resolved in that moment that he never wanted to see that happen again. So in his mind, leaders like Gorbachev, leaders like Khrushchev, whom he constantly blames for handing Crimea to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic, these two leaders to him are the worst. They represent the worst kind of leadership possible. They are weak, liberal men who couldn't hold the country together, that because in his mind, Russia can only be ruled by an iron fist, the way Stalin did it. And whenever you bring in any kind of liberalism to Russia, in his mind, everything goes to shit. I think the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan is a kind of, in his mind, and that was also the year that he faced down those protesters in Dresden in 1989. So I think in his mind, it's like, that's what happens when you admit you're losing a war and when you withdraw. Like, you never show weakness. If you show weakness, it's over. They will eat you alive.
So he's restored a totalitarian state, and now the Russian people are just resigned. A great majority of the Russian people are resigned to this, and including going into a maw where they have very good chance of not coming back.
Well, we don't know, really. That's the thing, is we don't know what the majority of the Russian people think. It's very hard to measure public opinion in a totalitarian state where telling your opinion to a stranger can put your life in danger, literally. So why would you share your honest opinion? So I mean, something that activists, democratic activists from Russia will tell you about, it's one of their favorite things to cite. They'll say that Romania's communist dictator Ceausescu had a 99% approval rating the day before Romanian crowds swept him from power and executed him. So we don't know.
Okay, but you're a Russian born and an expert on Russia, and that's not going to happen to Putin, or is it? I mean, we're not.
You have no idea. I don't know.
I know you know. Let's talk about the tanks.
Sure.
Okay. Let's talk about
love a good tank.
I hear like it's going to take a year for the Abrams tanks to get there and be operational. That can't be right. I mean, I've heard General McCaffrey say that's not right. That can't be. I mean, we have Abrams tanks in Europe already, so they can literally physically get there. And it can't take a year to train someone, can it?
I don't know. I'm not an expert in
tanks
and how long it's going to take them to get there. Apparently, what I do know is they have to be modified. They can't be exported with this uranium cover that they have. It's apparently this uranium mesh. It's like a degraded uranium. Ukrainians have to be trained. The logistic chains have to be set up, et cetera, et cetera. But it is going to take them longer to get there, from what I understand, than the Leopard tanks. And that it's the Leopard tanks that are going to make the bigger difference. And that's why the thinking goes. That's why the Biden administration released the Abrams tanks.
Which is to get the Leopards there.
Correct. To kind of kick the Germans in the butt and take away their one excuse for not, or their official excuse for not providing the Leopard tanks, and from holding back other European allies from giving their Leopard tanks, because they can't, they weren't authorized to give their Leopard tanks to the Ukrainians without German permission.
And the Ukrainians absolutely need this, considering the new configurations that the Russians are making in terms of trenches and in combating what the Ukrainian military had. Is that correct?
Yes, but they also need all kinds of other things. And there's an argument to be made that, you know, they needed the tanks not even yesterday, but they needed it like a couple months ago. And that it always takes the West a little too long to get Ukraine the weapons that they need. That we move and we budge on these things that we said, no, we're not going to send you Abrams tanks. No, we're not going to send you Abrams tanks. Then something like the missile attack, the cruise missile attack on the building, the residential building in Dnipro happens. And it's absolutely horrific. And the world is shaken by it. And then everyone's like, all right, fine, you can have the fucking tanks. But by then, a lot of Ukrainians are dead, or a lot more Ukrainians are dead. A lot more Ukrainian infrastructure is ruined, and the situation on the battlefield has changed again. And then, you know, we amp up our military assistance, and the Russians change their approach. And then that means we need to do something else. And this kind of incremental drip of military assistance where we, okay, no attack-ems. Okay, well, maybe we'll think about attack-ems, or no jets. Okay, well, maybe we'll start thinking about jets. Mm-hmm. It's like, maybe if we had done this kind of all at once. I think right at the beginning, I think there were some valid concerns. And I think some Ukrainian listeners might crucify me for saying this. But at the very beginning, there were real concerns that the Ukrainian army would be completely overrun by Russia. And basically, we would just be giving all this stuff to the Russian military. But once it was clear that the Ukrainians could fight and were fighting well, then, you know, this shouldn't be like, so there's a Russian expression, which is, I guess, the equivalent of the Seinfeld joke, you know, one of the Band-Aid joke, you know, one move right off. This is in Russian, you say, you know, don't cut off a cat's tail piece by piece. And I think that's kind of what the West is doing. Well, our versions are always darker. Anyway, but I feel like there's been this, you know, cutting off the cat's tail bit by bit aspect to this that has also made the war drag on longer and has contributed to the death of tens of thousands of Ukrainians, unfortunately.
Okay, so these tanks and also our Patriot anti-ballistic missiles are not there yet. They're not there yet.
Yeah, I think they're still getting trained on them. I think that's the other thing is like, when we announce that we're giving it to the Ukrainians, there's still, it's not like they appear in Ukraine that second. They have to be found, they have to be taken there, or they have to be taken to Europe where they can be trained. Although the Ukrainians will be training on the Patriots in Oklahoma. I think one of the reasons, for example, that the Abrams tanks won't be getting to Ukraine for a while is that they're not coming out of U.S. stockpiles, like some other weapons have. They're getting to Ukraine through a separate procurement program. So that takes a little longer too. And then on top of that, they have to be trained. Ukrainians have to be trained. The logistics networks have to be set up, etc. So when the announcement is made, that's just the beginning of the process.
Any good news? Is there any good news that you might share with
God,
us?
Americans always want good news. I love it.
American.
I mean, I think this war, I think the good news is that this war is still winnable for Ukraine. And then the other good news is that Ukraine's backers and allies in the West recognize that. They recognize that this war is winnable. They believe that this war is winnable. And they're still willing to help Ukraine do that. We can disagree on the speed, but there is still an understanding that Ukraine can really win this war. And that's good.
I mean, there's really no choice here.
Of course there's a choice. Talk to Mearsheimer, talk to, you know, the so-called realists or the far right MAGA Republicans. There are lots of people who think there's a choice.
Yeah. And their choice would be to, not fund this at all. Mm-hmm. And to allow the Russians to run over Ukraine.
Totally.
Okay. And where do the Russians stop?
Well, I don't agree with this, but I don't. I think they would probably also take Moldova, But at this point, I don't know how much they would be able to do. I don't think they would be able to overrun Ukraine anymore, because one of the most amazing statistics to come out of this is that the U.S. has used maybe 5% of its military budget.
And we don't have one troop on the ground, so right. We're not paying any price.
Not
that
a single
way.
American killed. So we've used maybe 5% of our military budget. So 5% of 13% of our federal budget to degrade by 50% the second army in the world, which is, you know, not just like a competitor, but our declared enemy. Right?
This is actually a good deal for...
It's a really good deal.
Yeah. And that is something that I think... And also, it's a good advertisement for our weapons. If you're in a, you know...
Which are mostly made in the deepest, reddest, most deepest red states in America. And create some, you know, these contracts, this ramping up of productions of javelins, which are made in Troy, Alabama, or Patriots, which are made, I believe, in Arizona. These are high-paying, high-skilled manufacturing jobs, which allegedly everybody wants to bring back to the U.S. There's just more high-skilled manufacturing jobs in the U.S.
I mean, that isn't usually a case that I would make. This is good for our weapons industry. But
you just made it. I heard it.
I know. And it happens to be true. So,
yeah.
But so for these right wingers who, they're basically American firsters, though. They just don't want us to be involved anywhere, I guess. Is that
right?
Well,
I think it's not just that. I think they don't want us to be involved anywhere, although they would love to fight China because they don't like China. But I think at the root of that is that I think there's quite a bit of sympathy for Russia. Because Russia is white, and they believe Putin's lies about the fact that Russia is a white, Christian, conservative country, and that the war in Ukraine is about fighting transgender rights. And, you know, because Putin, in a lot of his speeches, including, you know, his announcement to go to war in Ukraine, drags in these American culture war issues, trying very smartly to kind of get part of the American public on board, and trying to insert both himself and his war in Ukraine into the American right and the American culture wars. So I think there's like a latent, and in some ways not so latent, if you listen to Tucker Carlson, who still happens to be has the most popular show on American TV. I think there's a sympathy for Russia. So it's not just that they don't want America to be involved anywhere, it's that they don't understand why Russia's the enemy. They think we should be allied with Russia.
Tucker actually, I think the day before the invasion, said to his audience, Democrats say we should hate Putin, but why?
Yeah. I think he said it after the invasion too.
My question, if Trump had won the election, say, would we be helping Ukraine here, or would we? Well, this is magical thinking, because Trump didn't win, right?
Well, it depends who you ask.
Well, let's say you ask.
let's I'm say kidding. You ask. No, he didn't win. He didn't win. I don't know. I mean, there are some who say that Putin wouldn't have invaded. I think the timing kind of depended on American politics. I think he miscalculated what he thought was happening. I think January 6th was definitely one reason he went for it. I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan was one reason he went for it, because he thought America was too weak, too distracted, too riven by factionalism and, you know, chasing and biting its own tail to stop him, let alone rally its allies in Europe.
And Biden surprised him, and maybe a lot of people, by putting this coalition together.
Yeah. And I'm surprised that Putin didn't realize this. But, you know, for those of us who've been following this forever, you know, this was Biden's portfolio when he was vice president. And he was very much a hawk on this when he was Obama's vice president. He advocated for a much tougher line. He advocated for Ukraine getting weapons. in 2014 when Russia invaded Ukraine the first time. He was overruled by Obama, obviously. So I'm surprised that Putin didn't remember that or thought it wouldn't actually happen.
Right now, you're saying that it's a sort of not a stasis at this moment. It's a stasis, but that this is all still very much in question which way this is going.
Yeah, I think, from what I've heard, people inside the U.S. government are saying probably another 2 years. But who knows? They've been wrong before. They've also been right before. I don't know.
2 years. And how many have we seen? Do we have any estimate of how many Ukrainians have died? And do we have any estimate of how many Russians have died?
I haven't seen the updated figures, but if in September it was about 100,000 each, both killed in action and wounded.
From both sides.
For both sides. And that's not counting civilians. And that was, September. So I imagine it is well north of that now. I mean, that's a stunning number because that was only 6 months into the war.
And we're on the anniversary.
Almost a year. And so it could easily be double now. I don't know. It's most military experts will tell you that it's actually very, very hard to count casualties, especially as a war is going on. But I think it's safe to say hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost. Definitely on the Ukrainian side. And I don't know. Wars in this part of the world tend to rack up really high body counts really fast.
So if we're talking about two more years, we're talking mm-hmm. about unbelievable carnage.
Maybe millions, yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah. I mean, look, I wouldn't be surprised if the number, by the time we hit the one-year marker, if the number, including civilians and soldiers on both sides, were inching toward the 500,000 mark.
How badly is the infrastructure, the Ukrainian infrastructure, been destroyed? I mean, it is a very, very big country. But we were seeing these deliberate attacks, obviously, on the utilities, on energy facilities. How quickly are they repaired? Let's say after this is all over, Ukraine will have to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
What is that going to look like?
I think it's been damaged massively. I mean, whole cities and towns have been completely wiped off the map, from cities like Mariupol on the coast early on in the war to little towns like Bakhmut and Soledar are gone.
The Bakhmut is where the battle currently is in the Donbas region, right?
That's right. Again, in November, Ukrainian authorities were saying that about half of the country's electric infrastructure had been taken out of commission and damaged.
Now, when these Ukrainians this winter are without heat and without electricity and without water, how long does it take for them to get that electricity up and the heat up and the water up?
I don't know. I mean, we've heard of repair people getting killed while fixing these systems. It's been a milder winter than people feared, but still, it's quite cold.
Yeah.
People live in these big Soviet era and post-Soviet era, buildings with 20, 30 floors, and they're carrying water up and down the stairs. If you think about old people living way up there, it's not a coincidence. And I think one of the reasons that what we don't talk about, it's not just the human suffering. It's not that which is horrible. It's not just that the Russians are trying to get the Ukrainian population to submit, because they won't. I think it's just making them madder and more resolved to never surrender to the people who have brought them this much misery.
Well, that's what Zelensky said in Washington, which is basically that they want revenge.
Yeah, I think that's what I've been hearing. But I think the other...
That's what he said. That's what he said in the...
No, I mean, I've been hearing from people in Ukraine. But I think the other thing that we talk about less is that... And this is why Ukraine has been pleading for air defenses and why the U.S. is sending Patriots and might send them fighter jets, is that when Russians are pummeling their cities with these missiles, the Ukrainian military has to defend them. And they only have so many, you know, air defense shells, so much air defense capabilities, right? And eventually they have to start choosing between protecting their civilians in the cities, their electric power plants, their water plants, their sewage processing plants, and their troops in the field. And if you degrade that enough, the Russian military is clearly hoping to finally get air dominance and to be able to like come in with the planes and the bombs and do what they did in Syria, which is even worse than this. So I think that's also what the Russians are angling for. I think that's also something to keep in mind. And it's why the Ukrainians are pleading for more and better air defense systems. And it's not just to stop this, but it's to prevent the Russians from achieving total dominance of the skies in Ukraine, which is also pretty amazing if you think about it. The Ukrainians really don't have much of an air force. And almost a year into the war, Russia, again, which boasted that it had the second military in the world, still has not been able to achieve air dominance.
Well, how much of our sanctions been working against them? And how, I mean, a part of what we've, as you said, part of the advantage of to us in this is degrading the second largest military in the world. Are they second to us, or is China bigger than Russia?
Well, we thought they were. They are not nearly as good. I think everybody overestimated their capabilities.
Well, the performance of the Russian military.
No, both the performance and the capabilities and the machinery and everything, their logistics, everything, and that was at the beginning of the war, and now they are degraded by 50%. So they're definitely not the second largest, second best military in the world.
Well, I meant at the beginning of this. And also the sanctions are such that they can't build back, right?
It's harder to build back, but so far we've seen China filling in the gaps. They're going to, the Russians are going to Iran and North Korea to fill in the gaps. They're still building stuff. The thing, it's not that they can't. I mean, again, look at North Korea and Iran. They're still able to build missiles, and North Korea was able to, develop nuclear weapons while under absolutely crushing sanctions, far worse than what Russia's under. So it can be done. It's harder. It makes it slower. It makes it less efficient, more corrupt, if that's possible in Russia. But again, it slows it down, but I don't think it's impossible.
Obviously, the corruption in Russia is one of the reasons that the military just did not perform anywhere near what people expected from, you know, this great masculine army that Ted Cruz was so excited about.
Yeah, well, Russian men are rarely what they think they are, so...
Okay. but I mean, we thought we were fighting this very sophisticated military that had, you know, this unbelievably well-funded military that it turned out that because of a corruption just doesn't have the capabilities we thought they had. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I would say that it is, when it comes to Russia, kind of a tale as old as time, that it's always, I remember telling anybody who would listen back in 2017 when everybody was losing their mind about Russia allegedly electing Donald Trump. Everybody kept, who had never been to Russia, didn't know Russian, didn't know the culture, the society, any of that. And they kept talking about this country that was also called Russia, that was extremely capable and detail-oriented. And able to put together very detailed, highly technical plans and execute them. And all of us who had spent time in Russia, who knew the place, were like, but where is that country? Because it has the same borders as Russia. It's also called Russia. People also speak Russian in your country. But like, we don't know that country. They can't do anything right.
Well, they did interfere in our election.
They did. Correctly. They did. They did. It's not that they didn't. They just didn't like there. And it's not that they didn't invade Ukraine. They did invade Ukraine. I feel like it's a kind of, it's an analog. Like they definitely did. And they did do a lot of damage, but they're just not nearly as good as we think they are. We think they're like these, it's like because they're our adversary, we need them to be 12 feet tall and these supervillains. But their, you know, their villainy is always mitigated by their sheer incompetence.
But I think that they're more competent at some things than others. I think that's fair to say. And I think one of the things that
they're competent in incompetence, and they're competent at corruption.
But they were also competent in the way they interfered with their election, which was by spreading disinformation, by targeting people on Facebook, by taking that Cambridge Analytica data and targeting people, going on and looking at Black Lives Matter, sending them, Hillary calling black teenagers super predators, and tamping down the vote in Milwaukee and in Detroit and in Philadelphia, three states that Trump barely won.
Sure. But again, but they didn't create 30, 40 years of Republican disinformation on the Clintons. They didn't create a racist backlash to the first black president. They didn't create a lot of the kind of the groundwork that made all this possible. And again, they did a lot of damage in Ukraine. They, you know, they're destroying the country. But in so doing, we're seeing a lot of their incompetence.
Okay, Julia. What we got is a long slog ahead of us, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I mean, look, again, I worry that, although I think I'm still optimistic for Ukraine, but I am worried that Russia or Putin specifically thinks, looking at Syria, looking at World War II, that time is on his side and that the world will eventually turn away, or that they throw enough bodies at the meat grinder and that they eventually win this thing. Just with time and bodies. So I think that's also what can prolong this thing forever and can threaten to throw it to the Russians.
And to what extent does this become an issue in the next election and Americans are tired of
this? I don't
know.
They're still far away. I mean, as you know, this it's like 2 years is... It's like two centuries in American politics. Who knows where things stand in a year or two in Ukraine?
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.